Welcome back to another podcast. I'm Bob Furring, and I have a very, very special guest today. This lady is in the Hall of Fame, not one Hall of Fame, but at least two Hall of Fames. She entered the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1995 and the Rhythm and Blues Hall of Fame in 2012. Her name is Martha Reeves, and she is my guest today. Martha, thank you for so much for being on the podcast.
Well, thank you, Bob. I'm actually in four halls of fame.
You're in four halls of fame.
Alabama, Tuscumbia Music Hall of Fame, because I'm from Alabama, country western. And I'm also in the Rhythm and Blues Foundation. I've got a Pioneer Award. So I've got four Hall of Fames. I also have the Dove Awards. I'm kind of proud of having the Dick Clark American Soul Award given to me by Della Reese, who we recently passed away, who's also part of the name, Della Reese, Van Dyke Street. So I'm happy to celebrate 65 years in this business.
Wow. Well, we are so lucky to have you performing next month at Sun City Shadow Hills. Tell us about your early days. How did you get into singing in the first place?
Mama taught me how to sing at the age of three. I was presented at my grandfather's church, Metropolitan AME, and my older brothers let me sing background with them. Benny sang the lead, Thomas sang a harmony part with me, and we sang Jesus Met the Woman at the Well. Well, we won candy, and I took over the candy and became the leader because if they weren't kind to me, I wouldn't give them any chocolate-covered cherries. We had fun as children. We didn't have television. See, I'm that generation before TV. We used to sit up and listen to the radio, look at it and listen to it, and sing when Dad felt like taking his guitar down off the wall. Dad played blues guitar, and Mom idolized Billie Holiday. So music has always been a part of my life, and I've been singing as long as I can remember. When I first learned to talk, I was singing.
Is it common that the early Motown stars came up through the church?
I haven't met one performer, not just Motown singers. I haven't met one R&B singer who didn't sing in the church. Hmm. Everybody came from the church. In fact, my music is of such a nature that I can sing it in church. Every song I've ever sang, I could put my God in it. I could put my Jesus Christ in it. Hmm. Jesus is my reason I sing. He's the reason for this season. And Merry Christmas, by the way.
Thank you so much. So along the way, you were discovered and wound up going to Hitsville. I understand it. You described it yourself as not as a secretary, but as a singer who could type. And you started off doing some, actually becoming pretty important at Hitsville. And finally, you got your chance. How did that happen?
Well, I was the recipient of an award I won at an amateur show. It was a prize to sing at the 20 Grand, a club that is now defunct, but where everybody, all the big names appeared at the 20 Grand. And I was given three nights during the happy hour. I made $5 every night, and it was my first experience in a nightclub. I had just turned 21. When I finished my three songs, this man named William Stevenson, who was A&R director at Hitsville USA, a new record company that everybody had heard about, walked up to me as I was exiting my stage and gave me a card and said, "You have talent. Come to Hitsville USA." I was sort of disappointed because I thought I had met my Prince Charming. He was very attractive, and he was a very warm and friendly man. So I took the card and went backstage, and I looked at it, and on the card was a girl named Mary Wells, who had she had attracted Berry Gordy's attention when he was doing a record hop in the Gold Room of the 20 Grand with Marv Johnson. His record at that time was "You Got What It Takes," and she had given Berry this song and said, "Get one of your artists to sing," and she piped up, "Well, you know you took my heart, bye bye baby." And Berry said, "I'm going to make you the number one female vocalist." And he recorded her. She was only 14 when she approached him, but she was on this card that I had backstage. And then I looked at it again. They had a guy on there named Barrett Strong. He had a song out called "Money," and everybody needed money. It was my dad's favorite song. He didn't know what the record company was, but these people had become famous. There was a group called The Miracles on there, and they had a record out called "Get a Job." And everybody was looking for a job, and everybody needed money. So these songs were hitting home and hitting us right in our hearts. They had a guy on there by the name of Eddie Hollins who had a record out called "Jamie." And Jamie had gone to number one. But when I got to the company, I went the next day, mind you. I got a card on Sunday. I was there Monday morning at secretary time. When I arrived, I passed about 30 people who were standing on the doorstep, and they were waiting for their auditions. Well, I had a card, so I was business, and I breezed by all those people. And when I got to the desk, I asked to speak to Mr. Stevenson, and didn't Juana Royster, the receptionist, tell me, well, his name is Mickey. I said, that's his name. May I see him? And she buzzed the door, and there this man was, this good-looking man who hadn't gone home. He had actually been up all night writing this song for a drummer named Marvin Gaye. That was my introduction into Hitsville, USA.
Wow.
And the rest is history. He asked me to answer a phone until he got right back because he didn't expect me to be there. And he was busy trying to write this song instead of auditioning those 30 people who were on the stairs. He was A&R director, and I didn't know how important a man he was at the company when he gave me that card, but they had a way of going around scouting and getting the jazz players and calling them the Funk Brothers and finding the best singers and the best talent in the city of Detroit. We all wound up at Hitsville, USA. And the rest, like I say, is history. I started doing demonstration records and waited my turn for an audition. It never happened. My first hit record was written by Holland Doja Holland. Eddie decided he didn't want to be a singer. So he wrote a song for me and three girls that I had sang with previously before I became Martha LaValle. I was discovered as a single performer, Martha LaValle. And I called these girls in from their jobs and had them sing backup on a song called Stubborn Kind of Fella for this drummer named Marvin Gaye. And as his record was hitting, Holland Doja Holland wrote a song for us called Come and Get These Memories. So my history is intermingled because Motown was a family. And everybody wrote and performed and sang together. It was a wonderful place to be, Hitsville, USA.
The sparks must have been flying
comes,
there.
I kind of can take them through there and tell them where the action is because I was in there maybe 9 months before I had a hit record and went on my first Motown review. 94 one-nighters, mind you, with six acts and a 13-piece band.
Wow.
Yeah.
So did any of the performers write songs, too, or did you have writers and performers?
I wrote my first B-side, but I decided I'd better let the professionals do the writing, and I'll just do the singing.
Mm-hmm.
I think I sang more demos in the A&R department than any of the recording artists ever sang. I sang more songs demonstrating the writings of the different, there were 17 different writers in that office, and I was secretary to all 17 of them.
I see. And so then lightning hit. Was Heat Wave the first really big song?
My song is called Love. It's like a heat wave.
Yeah.
It was the first song to get us a Grammy nomination. But our first hit song was Come and Get These Memories.
Ah.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And we had a heat wave. We had a quicksand. We had a live wire. We had a Nowhere to Run. And we had a Jimmy Mac, which I think is our most requested song today. Jimmy Mac, when are you coming back?
I was going to ask, what's the story of Jimmy Mac? Who was Jimmy Mac?
There was a Korean War that was very close to the Vietnam War. And one didn't end before the other one started. They had written a song during the Korean War, but it was too lighthearted. They're also the authors of Freda Payne's Bring the Boys Home. The wars were very discerning. I mean, we had fear of war ever since 45 when, you know, they bombed. Oh, I hate to go back there in my mind.
Yeah.
I remember the Japanese.
It's okay. We don't want to either.
So Jimmy Mac was a continuation of all of this fear, and most of the people had gotten over the fact that Mr. Postman was their favorite song because everybody's looking for us to mail from their loved ones.
Mm-hmm.
The Marvelettes and the first girls group at Hitsville. So it's just a thrill to have a song like Jimmy Mac recorded during the wars.
Yeah, and your signature song, I think, is Dancing in the Street. What year did that hit?
It's a singular title. It's not Streets. It's Street, Dancing in the Street.
Ah, okay.
Marvin Gaye wrote it and was singing it when I was asked to sing it. He looked at me when I was standing in the door in admiration. He was singing it like a ballad. He looked over and saw me and asked William Stevenson and Ivan Hunter, his co-writers, if Martha could try it. He said, try this song on Martha. And I was surprised because I didn't think he saw me standing there. I just finished my artist development across the street. We had lessons for 4 years. We were taught to be performers. We had a training in music theory, choreography, and basic psychology, I guess is what you call it. what you call it, because it was giving us these proper manners for the stage and to make sure that the artist is the royalty. We had wonderful lessons. Motown was just more than a record company, but a school.
Yeah.
That's why I think all of us excelled. Barry Gordy was successful in making over 30 acts famous.
Yeah. You know, when I listen to those songs today, they're all so happy. They all sound so happy. And there was some bad stuff going on in those days. You had the Detroit riots. We had Vietnam. But you were able to. The songs stayed above all that. They brought a lot of happiness into our lives.
And always will. They're legendary, and I can sing any song. Like I said, in church, we have wonderful titles that taught people how to love one another and how to live on this world together.
Yeah.
And I think that was Barry Gordy's dream. He said it's what's in the groove that counts. And he wanted his song, his sound, Motown sound, to be the sound of young America. And if you look at your 45s real close, I had to tell a kid the other day, 45s were not guns. They were little round records with a donut hole. You put a disc in, they put them in the record player. Little kid asked me, well, what's a record player? I said, okay, give me an iPad and I'll tell you.
Yeah.
And so it was just a miracle that he knew what to tell the writers to write. He also competed with his writers. He had 17 guys on staff, and they needed a song for a group called The Contours. I saw Barry Gordy come in the A&R department, sit at the spinet piano that they had, and write Do You Love Me for The Contours. And all of his writers were asked to submit a song for the artist. Barry's won, because he would have meetings, and they would call it the quality control department, and they would listen to the songs and ask people like clergymen, secretaries, or different people he had worked with at Ford Motor Company, different people he had boxed with. He'd have them all come meet at the studio. He'd ask them, if this is a hit record, would you buy this record or a hot dog? And somehow that's how he chose what record out of the lot that had been collected for the different artists. He had a technique, but everything turned out quality.
Yeah.
The best musicians. My music didn't sound like anybody else's music.
Yeah.
They had a way of individualizing our sound.
So
music didn't sound like the Temptations or the Supremes or Gladys Knight and the Pips or any of those other people. My music had its own signature, and
yes.
So did theirs.
Uh-huh.
So it was a good spirit at Hitsville, USA, a real, real good music spirit.
So at some point, you quickly transitioned from being probably a pretty well-known singer in Detroit to becoming an international superstar. For those of us who are never going to experience that, what was that like?
Well, there was a gentleman from England by the name of Dave Godden who came to Hitsville, USA on a sunny day. Marvin Gaye and I were the only two artists in town to greet him, but he came on a mission. He had formed the Tamla Motown Appreciation Society in England with over 500 members, and he told Barry that our music was welcomed in London, England, to come to London, England, and bring his singers and his musicians. And that happened. It became reality, and we became famous not only in England but Europe. And we've been to Spain, we've been to Japan, we've been everywhere with our music. So it started with an invitation to England by Dave Godden. God rest his soul.
In those days, how many weeks a year were you on the road touring?
I have worked as many as 52 weeks in a year. I've worked as many as 42. And I thank God that show business isn't like that. I mean, we get a little bit of a break. We might work an average of maybe 30 weeks a year.
Because when you weren't touring, you were recording new music, right?
Whenever we were in town, we were either in school or in the recording studio. You know, Barry was smart. He made sure we were always busy. He never let us be idle.
So it's kind of hard to leave even a semi-normal life under those circumstances.
But then you have to ask yourself, Bobby, what's normal, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
There are no two entertainers alike. There's no two lawyers alike. There's no two teachers alike. So, you know, what can you say is normal about being on the road, living out of suitcases and eating popcorn, eating sardines and drinking water, sort of swelling your stomach and acting like you're full? When your budget was $5 a day and when you got back in town, you owed the company. You know, if you were on tour for 3 months and 94 one night is staying in only one hotel, you know, what is fair? What is normal?
Yeah.
But if you can stand it, if you can get to the people who love our music, who make it really
I don't know, I've got an obligation because so many people love the music. They want to see us.
Yeah.
And I can keep taking the invitations to come to different places because I know the music stands for itself. It's good music. And the musicians try their best to play like the Funk Brothers who recorded our product. Those were jazz artists, you know. Those were jazz musicians.
But in your own life, at some point, you left that. You came to California.
No, wait a minute. Slow down, Bob. They left me.
Oh.
My contract was up in 71. My son was just a year old when they left Detroit. They left me here.
Ah.
I followed them to California. Oh, yeah, life goes on. So like, you got to keep up. If you sit down, something will fall on you or roll over on you. You got to keep moving. And that's what I did. I attended the Lee Strasberg Theater Institute while I was recording for Universal. I went to Fantasy Records for two albums, and I also did Arista with Clive Davis for one album. So I've continued to record over the years. But no music has ever hit home like the Motown sound for me.
Yeah, true.
I'm recording on my own label now, and I've got a couple of albums. I got one for this Christmas season called Jesus is the Reason. And I wish you had it because you would play it, but I don't know distribution. I'll figure that out, too. But I've been inspired to do a Christmas gospel album, and it turned out real good.
Oh, that's nice.
That's what I'm promoting right now.
That's nice. And so, and also, and I don't know of any other performer who's done this, you found time to serve on the Detroit City Council.
Yeah, I had a good time doing that, but, you know, I'll never do that again. But my problem was I was famous when I got on there, so I didn't have any friends. I had a couple of people who I could relate to, but they didn't really like me because I was world travel, and a lot of my suggestions are just happening now. When I brought some things to the table, they looked at me and said, are you crazy? You know, thinking things like having roundabouts. And if you ever travel to England, you know that those are some of the traffic systems that make their daily routine easy, because you'll go around in a circle and you find an exit and you go where you got to go as opposed to stopping there and letting everybody else go by. You know, it's a system that has been working in England that a lot of things that I brought to the table, they couldn't grasp it when I suggested it, but I've seen the different things happen since I've been off the council. I'm glad I went. Okay, I think everybody ought to learn how the government runs, but I don't think that I'll ever do that again to myself. I was under scrutiny. They had investigative reporters following me around. They couldn't find anything really, really bad. Except I like casinos, you know, but that's an adult livelihood. It's a sport. And if you want to do it, if you have enough money, then go to the casino. There's nothing wrong with it. And, it's just simple things like that where they have rules and they want to check and make sure that your phone's, you know, tap your phone to see if you're talking to any gangsters, if you're making any deals. All of that I didn't have in my nature. But I was an honest person for the 4 years that I, from 2005 to 2009, I was honest and I gave it all my all. I sacrificed show business to a degree, but I never stopped working.
Yeah.
I always worked. Okay, and I continued. Whenever we had a recess or we had some days off, I made sure that that's how my management booked me. Management sort of suffered a little bit.
Wow.
But it was a sacrifice that I made, and it was good for me. It was good for me, and it was good for the city because I did a lot of good.
Nice. And so now you're back to performing full time. And how do you define that? How many performances a year are you averaging now?
I don't know if I could even answer a question like that. I know I'm busy.
Yeah.
I'm real busy. I hardly have time for my great grandchildren.
Yeah.
And this is the day that I'm supposed to have dinner with them. I've got two great grands, so life is good.
Yeah.
I'm still busy, and I just came back from England. And I had to go to Las Vegas to say goodbye to Pete Moore, one of the miracles, who just lost another soldier. He was the last of the background singers for Smokey Robinson and his wife, Claudette. They're the last two. And I had to go and say goodbye to Pete Moore. I've just been traveling around. I'm on the Sound Exchange board, and we just had a meeting in Los Angeles as it was burning. So, I mean, I'm busy, and I'm loving it. I ask God to let me stay busy, and that's what I've been doing. I do lectures in school. I do a whole lot of career days. I have places that I go where I actually sit in. If you have, like, jam sessions, I do a lot of that because I love jazz musicians. I think they're the best qualified people to make music because they studied their craft, and they know what the different notes are, unlike some of the noise that you hear today, that they're calling music using machines and not real people. But I'm enjoying just being a legendary singer and a senior citizen and a great-grandmother and an ex-politician. And I got my doctorate in humanities, and I also have my my master's in religious studies. So I'm learning how to read the book and understand it and explain it to other people. So I've got a good life. Indeed. I got a good life.
You've got a very busy life, that's for sure. Well, I'm so glad that you took the time to do this podcast with us, and we are so looking forward to seeing you out here in early January, performing right here at Sun City Shadow Hills.
So, you going to come and introduce us?
I would love to come and introduce myself to you, and I will talk to our director and Dundee and figure out how to do that.
DJs made us famous. Do you know, had they not played our music over and over again, nobody would ever bought it. We don't make any money when our music is played on the radio. We only get paid when somebody goes and actually purchases a CD or a 45 or whatever. So it's a joy to be able to talk to announcers, because you were our first rappers. You're the ones who talked people into buying our product, and I'm grateful. Very grateful.
Well, I think we're pretty close to sold out here.
And announcers like DJs usually do when they have us on their radios and invite their listeners to come and see us.
Yeah. Well, we're going to deliver a sold-out house for you when you come here.
All right. So come on and say hello to us and introduce us on stage.
I will do that. Martha,
right.
Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. This was very special.
Thank you, darling. Thank you so much. I look forward to seeing you and all of our people who love the Motown sound.
Yeah. And so for the podcast audience, thank you so much for listening. Until next time, bye-bye.